Details of the first Moresby raid come from the Australian Broadcasting Commission's war correspondent in New Guinea. He says that 19 heavy bombers and at least 3 Japanese fighters made the attack, which was directed against military objectives. The bombers came in 2 waves and operated from a great height. The enemy fighters flew across the aerodrome at the height of a few hundred feet and attempted to machine gun installations. Details of damage are not yet available. In the widespread air operations over the weekend, honors were all with the Allied Air Forces. Pounding hard at the enemy's advanced operational bases, our airmen tanked 1 Japanese cruiser, badly damaged another, and destroyed or damaged at least 23 Japanese aircraft. In these operations, 2 of our aircraft were knocked with their personnel, and 4 airmen were wounded in a bomber. In raids by the Japanese on North Australian towns, 2 civilians were killed. Allied air attacks were carried out over a wide arc extending from New Britain to Timor. The Japanese warships were battered in the harbour at Rabaul. Of the total tally of 23 enemy aircraft, 17 were destroyed or damaged on the ground in a fierce attack by our bombers on Lae, L-A-E, in New Guinea. Our aircraft also carried out bombing raids on enemy installations on the island of Yamdena, Yamdena, about 300 miles north of Australia, and on Koepang, K-O-E-P-A-N-G, in Timor. In the same period, Japanese planes made 4 raids on points on the Australian mainland. Minor attacks were made against the West Australian ports of Broome, B-R-O-O-M-E, and Derby, D-E-R-B-Y, on Saturday. On Sunday morning, Darwin was attacked by enemy aircraft for the 6th time, and bombs were dropped at Catherine, a railway town 170 miles inland from Darwin. There is as yet no report of fighting in the Markham Valley, where the Japanese have consolidated positions after their landings at Lae and Salamaua. However, a clash in this region between Australian and Japanese troops is believed to be imminent. Yesterday, a small Australian patrol made a daring sortie into Salamaua to find out the enemy's strength and disposition. The men in the patrol were experienced bushmen with an intimate knowledge of the country. Taking advantage of every available cover, they managed to penetrate right behind the Japanese lines and brought back valuable information. War correspondents in New Guinea say that the Japanese have not attempted to move far inland along the Markham Valley, contenting themselves with the occupation of some aerodrome. Their failure to advance further at present is attributed to the continual Allied hammering of their bases at Lae and Salamaua. These attacks have made the reinforcement and supply of the Japanese forces a more difficult problem than was anticipated. 13 ratings from His Majesty's Australian sloop Yarra, which was lost in action off Java 3 weeks ago, have been picked up from a rock and are now safe in a British port. No details of their rescue are yet available. Allied Supreme Commander in the Anzac area, General Douglas MacArthur, called on Australian Army Minister Forbes this afternoon. Lieutenant General Sturdy, Chief of Australian General Staff, was also present. Mr. Forbes said later that they discussed the present position of the war preparations, the extent of American aid, and the policy that will be adopted by the United Nations. He added, quote, "I am satisfied that General MacArthur is a master of strategy, and that under his direction, an aggressive attacking policy will be developed to the highest possible degree," unquote. In a 2-hour interview with Australian and overseas newspaper men today, General MacArthur expressed frank views on the war situation. By the force and directness of his answers, General MacArthur created a profound impression. Writing of the interview in tonight's Melbourne Herald, newsman Clive Turnbull says, quote, "I cannot reveal what General MacArthur talked about, but I can say that no one who heard him, Australian or American, could fail to be heartened. Not only heartened because of what he said, but heartened also by the manner in which he said it. When you meet this man, you realize how it was that he infused the mixed forces of the Philippines with a heroic fighting spirit that stood the Japanese off and gave them blow for blow. Australians will take General MacArthur to their hearts, for he has all the qualities that we most admire: courage, brains, and a belief in the people. He is straightforward to a degree. His conference today was a model of candor, and that candor has its own reward. When MacArthur says it, you believe it. When you come away from talking with him, you think, well, perhaps it's going to be tough, but we can tackle it. And now let's get on with the job. On first. Among the scores of messages of good wishes which have been received by General MacArthur since he arrived in Australia are cables from General Sir Archibald Wavell and from Marshal Chiang Kai-shek. From New Delhi, General Wavell sent the following message. I wish you all good fortune and success in your new command. And so, to which General MacArthur replied, quote, thanks for your thoughtful message. We'll do our best. And so, Marshal Chiang Kai-shek cables, quote, news of your appointment as Commander-in-Chief of Australia and New Zealand fills me with delight. I feel confident that under your leadership, a new and epic chapter of military success and human achievement will be added to the history of our common struggle against treachery and barbarism. Unquote. General MacArthur replied, quote, deeply appreciate your inspiring message. I have absolute confidence in complete victory. Unquote. Mrs. Douglas MacArthur today expressed deep gratitude for the cordial welcome she has received in Australia. In a message to Australian women, which she gave at the request of representatives of women's journals, she said, quote, everybody has been very kind since we arrived, and the warm and cordial greetings have impressed me very deeply. Australian women are so much like American women that I feel quite at home. Arthur, my young son, stood the strenuous trip very well and especially enjoyed the train trip through the country. While I am here, I will devote most of the time to General and Arthur as I have in the past. That's my real message to the women of this lovely country, to help our men in every way to do their work well. Unquote. 51 Japanese aircraft were shot down in aerial combat by Australian squadrons serving in the Malayan campaign. Many more Japanese planes were destroyed on the ground during day and night attacks on enemy aerodromes. A senior Australian Air Force officer who had just returned from the Far East said today that Australian airmen had fought magnificently against odds. They'd given warning of the approach of enemy convoys towards Kota Bharu, Endau and Palembang, and had subsequently bombed Japanese troop ships and landing parties on the beach. On each occasion, they'd scored heavily. The Australian wing had also done great work in protecting our own forces, and credit for the arrival in Singapore of six large convoys of reinforcements and equipment was due largely to them. A Sydney transport executive, Mr. T.A. White, wants to be a human bomb. He has made an offer in a letter to Air Minister Drakeford, in which he writes, quote, I offer to hold the stick of a plane in a dive after the pilot has bailed out, or drive a fast motorboat well stocked with explosives into a Japanese aircraft carrier and trust them not. I'm a married man in a good position, but the results would be worth the price. Perhaps you could get 20 other fools like me and wipe out quite a party of the enemy. Unquote. Australian newspapers are insisting that the fate of the whole war in the Pacific depends on the cooperation between this Commonwealth and the United States. In its leading article today, the Melbourne Herald emphasizes that a long-term plan of cooperation will not meet the need. Cooperation has to become effective now. In its article headed, Next Month May Be Terminate, the Herald says, quote, between the fine round figures of production and the numbers of aircraft actually delivered and ready for training and fighting and bombing, there's a discrepancy which is bound to leave the layman bewildered and skeptical. The official assurances of the speed of construction need to be qualified, and the public will set against the quantities and percentages recently announced the failure of a long succession of campaigns because in large measure of the inferior numbers and quality of aircraft available. When the Malayan campaign began in December, the Imperial forces had at their disposal probably fewer than 300 aeroplanes, many of these obsolete or obsolescent, and often incapable of handling the raids by the formidable Japanese machine. Now we have a statement by Mr. Donald Nelson, Chief of American War Production, that the United States is producing aeroplanes at the rate of nearly 3,000 a month. This is, of course, an aggregate figure. It must include a high proportion of trainers and of other aircraft which cannot be reckoned with in active operation. Nor will by any means all of the first-line aircraft rolling out of American factories be available for dispatch to the immediate battle zone. Yet, allowing for the inevitable wastages in and out of war operations, for the delays of switching over to full war production, and for the numbers which must be lost in transit until the Allied nations recover command of the seas, there still is a tantalizing disparity between aeroplanes on the factory schedule and aeroplanes on the tarmac. Australia would be happier about the prospect of repelling invasion if only 1 month's American production, at the rate specified by Mr. Nelson, stood in actuality at this moment on her battle station. It is to American productive capacity that Australia must look for salvation. And Dr. Everett in Washington is properly urging, with the bluntness demanded by the occasion, that next month may be too late. We must do it now. His advocacy on the spot, coupled with General MacArthur's reminder in Melbourne that his success or failure, and these are the General's words, will depend primarily upon the resources which the respective governments place at my disposal. These words should leave no doubt in America of the slender margin of the time factor. Greater efforts yet in production, transport, and organization on either side of the Pacific are called for to stiffen this essential Allied air arm of defense and counterattack. Australia's survival may depend on how long aeroplanes take from the end of the assembly line to the point of delivery and manning and operative readiness at the more threatened poles of the Commonwealth. While depending so heavily upon America, and encouraged by President Roosevelt's declaration that he's doing everything possible in the Southwest Pacific, we ourselves must be ready to take the first shot and to stand the enemy off until the fabulous thousands of aeroplanes from our ally are in our own skies. Yesterday's raid on Katherine, 180 miles inland from Darwin, was the deepest penetration into Australian territory the Japanese have yet made. The daring of the enemy does not decline. His aircraft had to fly at least 300 miles over Australian soil after the long flight from his nearest base. The tactical significance of the raid on Katherine we don't yet know. But in its wider sense, and the warning it conveys, are only too plain. The Japanese lost only one machine in this and the Darwin raid. The call is for more aeroplanes and especially for fighters. This much we can say with Mr. Nelson. We need more and we need them now. Over. That's the end of the Herald article. That also ends today's news review from Australia, read by John Roy. And here is our commentary for North American listeners. There are some commentators overseas who seem to fear that Australians may accept General MacArthur, Allied commander in the Southwest Pacific, as a miracle man, and who seem to believe that we are prepared to throw on him the entire burden of winning the war. However this may be, Australia has been admonished by newspapers on both sides of the Atlantic to remember that MacArthur is, after all, only human, and that the forces with which he is supplied are only human too. Well, Australians accept these admonitions in the spirit of friendliness in which they're prompted. But they can assure the world that they've no simple faith in the ability of any single person, or any single armed force, or any single war factor to achieve victory. They are well aware that the job in hand is one that calls for the maximum labor, the maximum austerity, the maximum courage. They are aware that this is a war to be waged not by any single government machine, that by every individual in every country aligned against the Axis. That's the measure of Australian reality. In the past few years, we Australians have seen far too much responsibility placed upon the shoulders of individuals to permit ourselves to fall into a similar error now with General MacArthur. We've watched how the victor of a single battle has been built up to Superman status and grossly overloaded for the job of campaign winning without having the necessary men and weapons. We've no intention of being so unjust to so great a soldier as MacArthur. We've no intention of flying against the lessons of recent history. We know that no development in this war, no sudden access of new strength to this Commonwealth from our side, relieves us of the responsibility of using every ounce of our own power in the cause for which we have pledged so deeply. The people of this country have got a deep emotional satisfaction from the arrival here of General MacArthur and the forces of the United States. That's perfectly true. We would be solid indeed if the valor of MacArthur's stand in the Philippines and the obvious evidences of his talent in leadership failed to move us. We would be almost subhuman in our responses if we failed to react quickly and even a little noisily to the arrival here of American air and ground troops. We've been inspired by both events, but we have not become intoxicated by them. We know that MacArthur comes to us today with a world reputation as a great and gifted soldier. We know that in taking under his command Australia's military forces, he entrusts a great deal of his military reputation to the fighting men of this Commonwealth. We are very conscious of the new responsibility we have thus acquired. And we are determined that MacArthur of the Philippines shall lose nothing of his luster by his association with the military forces of this country. We are just as jealous of his reputation as are his own countrymen. We know that given the help and the equipment necessary for the tremendous task he faces, MacArthur can repeat, in this corner of the Pacific, the glory of Bataan. But we know that MacArthur cannot do this alone. Therefore, whatever we can do to give him that help will be done. We will make every sacrifice so that we may assist in fashioning for him the tools of victory. If there were any tendency in this country to believe that the developments of the last few days indicated a swift reversal of the present position in the Pacific, we would not be moving continually towards new callings up, new mobilizations, new restrictions on the unessential things of life, and to new austerities. Prime Minister Curtin has declared repeatedly the intention of his administration to place this country on a total war footing. If we are not already upon that footing, it's because we, like every other democracy in the world, found it difficult to make the sweeping adjustments necessary and found it repugnant to surrender even for a time those liberties we've always enjoyed. But today, the mood of this country is hard. We know that since September 1939, there have been weeks and months at the locust of Eden. We were not the only victims of that weakness. It was pretty general throughout the democratic world. Now we've risen above such faults, and we're all the better for them. We're much like a man who has discovered within him some constitutional weakness and has taken the proper steps to fortify himself against its effect or to remove its cause. The present mood of Australia is expressed by one of our most influential newspapers, which declares that today there are no rights worth a damn until the enemy is beaten. It echoes the Australian belief that the hour of talking about privileges and money and rights and wages, profits or anything else, all that is past. It adds, quote, if a man comes out of this war with a whole skin, with his wife and family safe, and with the capacity to earn an honest living, then he should fall down on his knees and thank God, unquote. That's the mood of realism that's upon this country today. It's not a mood which will allow us to sit back and cast our burdens on any one man. We are proud that MacArthur has been given the command of this vital area. Our pride is all the greater because we know that this Commonwealth is today a highly vital area. We know that its function must be that of a great allied base. We know that its organization for that job must be faultless and complete. We know that we've ceased to be merely just another country in the path of Axis aggression. We've acquired new importance as an allied force. Our sense of responsibility in these things weighs heavily upon us. We know how heavy the responsibility of his tremendous office weighs upon MacArthur. We Australians will not increase his burden by resting our weight upon him. It will be our job and our privilege to give him all the strength we have so that his ability to bear his burden will become greater. In this resolve, we take second place to no one, not even to MacArthur's own great country. He has pledged his soldier faith to us. We pledge our national faith to him. So that this war, which is not a war for the freedom of the United States or of the British Commonwealth or of Greece or Czechoslovakia, but of the whole world, may be ended as swiftly as possible by the utter defeat of the Axis. That's the end of our new service and commentary for North American history.